Welcome back to our show, and I'm excited to introduce our next guest, the Executive Director of the American Telemedicine Association, Kyle Zebley. Hello, Kyle. Thank you for joining our show.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
Let's get into this. So we last spoke with Kyle Zebley in January with our Mass State Senator, Patrick O'Connor, and there's a lot going on with using telehealth to fight the COVID pandemic across the country. And I was hoping you could help shed some light on the recent announcement of the bipartisan telehealth bill sponsored by Rep. Liz Cheney that extends until the end of 2024 and how it affects the following telehealth laws currently in place, such as geographic and originating sites flexibilities, expanded eligible practitioners, FQHCs and RHCs, telehealth coverage and reimbursement, delay of the in-person telemental health requirement, furnishment of audio-only telehealth, and use of telehealth to satisfy Medicare face-to-face requirements.
Well, yeah, no, it's a really exciting news, and it's a huge boost for the telehealth community. At the end of July, it all happened pretty quickly, but the leadership of the House brought to the floor this bill, as you said, introduced by Representative Liz Cheney and also Representative Debbie Dingell from Michigan. And so it was bipartisan, and it really meets so many of the objectives of the telehealth community. It extends until the end of 2024, all those provisions you just mentioned, which are really some of our highest objectives. It would make sure that the American people, and in particular Medicare beneficiaries, don't go off the telehealth cliff that we talk about so frequently, where they might suddenly lose access to the benefits of virtual care if Congress doesn't take action before the public health emergency. Still ongoing, still in effect. We were really supportive of it. We really were urging members of Congress to support it. It ended up having really shocking levels of support in the House of Representatives, passed 416 to 12. So fully 96% of the House of Representatives voted in favor of it. And so it was really near unanimous support. Interested to see, of course, what will happen in the Senate. There's no need, no requirement for the Senate to do anything with it, of course, if they don't want to. But we know we have our great bipartisan supporters in the Senate. One of the leading pieces of legislation, in addition to Representative Cheney's, is the Connect for Health Act that's been introduced many Congresses running. And as it stands right now, as of today, two-thirds of the Senate are co-sponsors of that really good bill, the Connect for Health Act, already. So I hope that the Senate will take it up and will pass it. I will say, real quick, as good as the bill is, and with all that it accomplishes, it's nothing but a good thing. There are items left out that are big priorities for us. There's a really favorable tax provision for telehealth for high deductible health plans, the 35 million Americans that have those plans that will expire at the end of this year unless Congress takes action. There's the ability to prescribe controlled substances remotely, you know, virtually without an in-person visit that has been in effect for the duration of the pandemic. That those in-person visit requirements will come back if Congress doesn't take action before the public health emergency ends. So we hope this bill becomes law, but even if it does get passed as is, and we have really a lot of reasons to be optimistic given that huge support in the House, Congress's job won't be done. There'll be still more to do.
Absolutely. I think, you know, for our listeners out there, you know, to let their legislators know to support this legislation, because there's always more to do. And if we can at least move things down the field a little bit, that's kind of the nature of government, right? We just sort of continue to move and build on each piece of legislation.
Absolutely.
As we think about that for our listeners that are out there, and I know we listed out the pieces that are included in the bill sponsored by Representative Cheney and as you said, is that Representative Dingell from Michigan?
That's right.
Yes.
That's right.
Explain to our listeners a little bit about some of the nuances around this. So for those that aren't in healthcare every single day, like all of us are, what does it mean to have something like a geographic site restriction? Or what I think people might have heard and wondered about is the delay of the in-person telemental health requirement. That those are things that might affect people every day.
It sure does. Prior to the beginning of the pandemic, Medicare fee-for-service Part B beneficiaries had very little access to reimbursable virtual care as part of the Medicare program. Basically, you had to meet two criteria. You had to be in a defined geographic area, a rural area, as defined by Medicare, and you had to be in an originating site that was the four walls physically of a provider's office. So that's kind of head spinning. Doesn't make a whole lot of sense. The reason why it's so it seems so antique is that it was passed into law in 1997 in the Clinton administration when you still needed a telephone line and a CD-ROM to get on American Online. So a very different day and age in terms of what was possible technologically. We had long as a community been opposed to these geographic and originating site restrictions. And very quickly into the pandemic, through the Public Health Emergency Authority, those restrictions were waived. And consequently, no matter where you're geographically located, no matter what your originating site is, to include your home or wherever the patient is in question, you have access as a Medicare beneficiary to virtual care. Those are huge barriers we want to see permanently addressed. And we just want to maintain the status quo as it's been now for 2+ years during the pandemic. It also, this Cheney bill, H.R. 4040, also forestalls the implementation of an in-person requirement for telemental health, access to mental health care services virtually. That's a great thing. Telemental health during the pandemic was made a permanent part of the of Medicare Part B, regardless of what Congress does or on other items, regardless if the PHE ends, the public health emergency ends. But unfortunately, they tied this in-person requirement to access to virtual telemental health services. Basically, prior to you having access as a beneficiary to mental health services, you'll have to have gone in person to that same provider prior to you being able to have a virtual relationship. And you'll have to periodically see in between virtual visits that provider in person in order to qualify. There's no clinical reason for in-person requirements. It's really nothing other than an artificial barrier to care. It'll exacerbate the mental health challenges the country's facing. It'll exacerbate the lack of mental health providers we have. In-person requirements in general are an existential threat to the industry that we oppose because it doesn't allow for telehealth to really be working at the top of its potential. And it's not just the American Telemedicine Association that say this. The American Medical Association, the Federation of State Medical Boards, the American Psychiatric Association, the American Psychological Association, and the list goes on, are opposed to these kinds of in-person requirements. And so great to see it won't be implemented if the Cheney bill becomes law. And in the long run, we need to permanently repeal that in-person requirement.
So important. Thank you for that explanation. I think that our listeners will really appreciate that. And as you pointed out, this is yet another time when policy is really lagging around innovation. So that's not unusual, not specific to healthcare. That's true in all sectors where policy has a hard time catching up. But the problem is it can be a difference between life and death or care and no care in the case of telehealth, and certainly our clinician shortages, as you pointed out, from a physician and a nursing perspective, will just exacerbate if we're required to have them in person. There's simply not enough clinicians to care for everyone, and we're not graduating them fast enough.
Couldn't agree more. And just sorry, just to say in quick reflection, Michelle, if we're going to squeeze efficiencies out of the behemoth that is the U.S. healthcare system, if we're going to make it truly capable of all the things that the 21st century technology can do, and if we're going to maximize our limited and ever decreasing healthcare workforce and address that massive shortage that's only exacerbating as the baby boom generation, for instance, retires, and as we grapple with the great retirement that has come out of the pandemic, then we're going to have to deploy virtual care at every step of the healthcare continuum. There's no other way to do it. You're not going to solve for these challenges without telehealth as a tool.
There'll have to be some redesigning, some changes in order to keep up with that. We talked a little bit about that and the idea of even having a virtual first approach with healthcare previously. So in our previous interview, so definitely more to come there. We'll see how that all shakes out.
Yeah, it would slow things down. And you mentioned earlier going to do your banking and going to the bank and doing it via internet. It's so much faster. This would be like, oh, well, you have to go to the bank before you can withdraw money. And we're only open such and such, and the doctor's only in. So makes perfect sense. Things are speeding up and people are requiring more to stay healthy. And I did a little research on my own on the Disabilities Act and limited English speaking people. This is the 32nd anniversary of the Americans Disability Act, and the DOJ and Health and Human Services is partnering to provide guidance on Americans with disabilities and limited English speaking person to be able to use telehealth safely. The Department of Justice released an ADA guidance on telehealth on July 29th, which is a person who is blind or has limited vision may find that the web-based platform their doctor uses for telehealth appointments does not support screen reader software, or a person who is deaf and communicates with a sign language interpreter may find that the video conferencing program their provider uses does not allow an interpreter to join the appointment from a separate location. And then a limited English proficient person, an LEP, may need instructions in a language other than English about how to set up a telehealth appointment. So these are some of the things that I think come in with telehealth and keep things safe and provide access to care for everyone with disabilities or limited English speaking.
Kyle, tell us what the implications are there for those changes from the DOJ and the partnership there with ADA.
Right. Well, it's obviously something that's really important to the members of the American Telemedicine Association and telehealth providers across the country. At the end of the day, as we really try to hammer home, telehealth is health. It's not anything separate and apart. We should just be considered part and parcel of the U.S. healthcare system. And that's what the community is asking for. That means that we don't want to be held to higher standards, but what we absolutely want to do is be held to the same standards, just as we want to make sure that our platforms are compliant with the Americans with Disabilities Act. It's one of the great bipartisan achievements of the last 35 years, celebrating its 32nd anniversary this year. I think it's one of the accomplishments that President George H.W. Bush was most proud of when he signed it into law. We want to make sure that telehealth is a tool to address the challenges of underserved and disadvantaged communities. First among those would be those communities that, you know, under which the ADA applies. And I think our members and many of the organizations that are delivering these needed services, of course, are already keeping this in mind. And this guidance will help really steer them in that right direction as we make sure that telehealth can meet the needs of all of the diverse populations of the United States, because we're really firmly of the belief that there is no American that does not stand to benefit from access to telehealth in some way, shape, or form. And this is just part of that effort.
That's a good point. And I wonder if I can stretch the edges of that a little bit. How far would that go if the ADA did say, you know, or DOJ and HHS started to point to the ADA and say, if we're going to provide telehealth capability to folks that can easily receive that, that in fact, those that do not have, say, broadband capability or other internet capability are now in some way covered under that umbrella of a not necessarily a physical disability there, but certainly a an inability to receive care. So like I said, I'm stretching the edges there, but how do we see potential overlap, or I'm thinking that through.
Right. Well, I think that through, for instance, the bipartisan infrastructure package that was passed last year that set significant money aside to invest in broadband capability for underserved communities, that mindset is present, even though the ADA is not being invoked. If you look at the work that an advisory panel on equity and underserved communities is suggesting to our CEO of the ATA, Anwan Johnson, in terms of making sure folks have access to devices, making sure that we're breaking down the barriers on digital literacy, and also making sure there are other restrictions that uniquely challenge some communities more than others, then I think that is a big part of the theme of your question, even if the ADA is not being invoked. In terms of directly invoking the ADA, I mean, obviously,
It might not be appropriate.
However, I think that what the country has done in response is pretty remarkable. And despite perhaps some concerns that the ADA would lead to too many regulatory hurdles, I think it's been reasonably applied. In the general thrust of these recommendations and the guidance that's coming out now is for reasonable accommodations. They're not asking for the impossible. They're asking for what's reasonable. Makes a lot of sense. And so even if the ADA is not being directly invoked, the spirit of what you suggested is very much at top of mind for both policymakers and for advocacy organizations like the ATA.
Absolutely. And I think when we think about the systems that are out there, you know, speaking to those that may be listening during our radio show, or even as it's replayed, some of the systems and vendors that are out in the market will be, if they haven't already, will be working on making sure that they do have multi-language and screen reading and some of the other requirements out there. So a little bit of work potentially for some to do, but I'm sure that everyone will be trying to meet the need. Any other legislation out there that we should all be aware of? You mentioned Connect for Health, and we've talked about HR 4040, and certainly the recent the ADA discussion that we just had. Anything else we should be aware of?
Well, there are pieces of legislation out there that would address those issues that I raised that were not included in HR 4040. That includes the Telehealth Extension and Evaluation Act that's been introduced in both chambers. Very comparable to HR 4040, the Liz Cheney bill, that would extend a lot of the flexibilities that have come about in Medicare for 2 years post-PHE. But unlike the Cheney bill, it includes action on the remote prescribing of controlled substances that are so important. Those vulnerable populations relying on those remote prescriptions for clinically appropriate care. We want to make sure they're not left behind. Then also, I would just say there are pieces of legislation out there that would extend or make permanent that high deductible health plan issue. That's a top priority for us. And so we're trying to make sure that that those bills have oxygen to get across the finish line.
I think those are great. And then I think there's also a lot of action aside from federal action, but at the state level, and how these individual states will be addressing things like payment parity and other requirements around providers. And certainly, as we've talked about many times, Kyle, on the licensure challenges that we have across state lines.
Yeah, if you're an organization that's seeking to deliver healthcare and all you're paying attention to is the federal level, go check with your lawyer quick, because you can be out of whack significantly with the Commonwealth of Massachusetts or another great nearby state. States are where questions of licensure, questions about practice of medicine, questions of Medicaid coverage, questions of commercial coverage, that's where those areas are determined. And so for a lot of our members, actually, it's quite the reverse of what I just said. Seeing positive progress at the federal level is a nice to do and nice to see, but they really live or die by what transpires in terms of state legislation and state regulation. So you can never let your eye off the ball, and you have to keep track of all 50 states if you're in a national organization and association like the ATA.
Absolutely. And I'll just say finally, Joe, that, you know, for listeners, it may not be daily and aware of the American Telemedicine Association. They're always focused on improving the industry, ensuring that we have best practices defined for the industry of telehealth and healthcare related to virtual services, quality of care, and of course, Kyle's work in advocacy and public policy shaping. So thank you so much for being here today.
Great. Thanks so much. Really appreciate it. And this has been wonderful. Keep up the great work.
Yeah, thanks, Kyle. This is Blue Cirrus Radio on WATD 95.9 FM. We'll be right back.